In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. 8 years ago, next week, we gave birth to a daughter, Isabella. And 8 years ago, next week, we lost her 5 days after she was born. And people wrote to us and emailed us and would have that look on their faces, that look that would say, oh, how awful that you lost a child, but how much worse it is that you lost her during Christmas. And we looked at each other and we thought to ourselves, yeah, how awful it was that we lost a daughter and how awful it was that we lost her at Christmas time. And yet then we had a second thought that said, you know what? This may be the clearest Christmas we've ever had. Yeah. Because it's perhaps the very first time in our entire life, where we've ever had to have a hope in Christmas, where that hope is ultimately to be found, not in this world, not in a song or in a decoration or in a festivity or in a present. It has to be found where it was meant to be found, which is why Christmas is meant to be ultimately Mary, because there is a hope that's not of this world that cannot be taken. That was our hope, and it was the clearest Christmas we've ever had, or perhaps ever since. We're in the season of Advent to remember Israel's hope of a promised Messiah. We're doing that because we have to learn to hope too. We have to practice it. Isabella's problem was that she had a chromosomal defect that would not allow her to breathe. She just couldn't breathe. Have you ever given thanks for your autonomic nervous system that allows you to breathe even when you don't even think about it? Even when you fall into the deepest slumber, it's your autonomic nervous system that keeps you from suffocating. We're born knowing how to breathe, but we're not born knowing how to hope. We have to learn how to hope. We have to have it born in us, and we have to have it reborn in us. And that's why we're, during the season of Advent, looking at the story of Ruth. Because it is a story, it is a narrative of people who had lost their hope and had to have that hope reborn, which is why we're calling the series Birthing Hope. This week, we're in the chapter where hope is beginning to take its first fledgling steps again. And the person who's at the center of the narrative, it's not Ruth, it's actually Naomi, she's already articulated her beliefs about God. And those beliefs are mainly that she thinks God is out to get her. But starting today and for the rest of the narrative, we're going to discover how Naomi's beliefs about God change. And those beliefs change by other people believing God. When you think about believing God, you tend to think about what it means to believe about Him. What is He like? What does He do? But it's not the same as believing God. We want to look at the chapter that I think shows us what it means to believe God. You ever think about what that means? We're going to listen in chapter 2, and we're going to consider what it means to believe God, because it's in believing God that hope shall be reborn. Would you stand? It's long. If you need to sit, stay seated, but we're in chapter 2. Would you stand?
Ruth chapter 2. Now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him, in whose sight I shall find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." So she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem, and he said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." And they answered, "The Lord bless you." Then Boaz said to his young man who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" And the servant, who was in charge of the reapers, answered, "She is the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers.' So she came, and she has continued from early morning until now, except for a short rest." Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn." Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?" But Boaz answered her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Then she said, "I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I am not one of your servants."
And at mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come here and eat some bread and dip your morsel in the wine." So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed to her roasted grain. And she ate until she was satisfied, and she had some left over. When she rose to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, saying, "Let her glean among the sheaves, and do not reproach her. And also pull out some from the bundles for her, and leave it for her to glean, and do not rebuke her." So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. And she took it up and went into the city. Her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She also brought out and gave her what food she had left over after being satisfied. And her mother-in-law said to her, "Where did you glean today, and where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, "The man's name with whom I worked today is Boaz." And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." Naomi also said to her, "The man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers." And Ruth the Moabite said, "Besides, he said to me, 'You shall keep close by my young men until they have finished all my harvest.'" And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women, lest in another field you be assaulted." So she kept close to the young women of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvest. And she lived with her mother-in-law. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Thank you. If you are just joining us, then there's a little context that we probably need to supply you. This is a story that takes place during the time of the judges. If you know about that era in Israel's history, it is between the time that Israel enters into the land and before they are given a king by God. The era was, to say the least, a mixed bag. The judges, there were some of them who ruled Israel with great courage, with great wisdom. There were also judges toward the end of that era whose leadership was pretty much horrendous. End of story there. And in this account, in Ruth, that era, that dark era, is darkened further by the coming of a famine in the land, which is ironic because this family lives in the city of Bethlehem, whose name means house of bread. And that family, where the husband is named Elimelech, the wife is named Naomi, they have two sons. They migrate to the region of Moab. They settle, they find food, but then the father dies. And then the sons grow up to marriageable age. They marry Moabite wives, and then those boys die. And so here's this woman who is Naomi. She's beyond middle age. She's got two daughters-in-law. She's got no husband, no sons to provide or protect her. But more importantly, she has no possibility of an heir to keep the name of her deceased husband intact so that that estate might not pass out into oblivion. It's a big deal. It's a big deal. And so Naomi, hearing that there is now fertility back in the region of Bethlehem, she sets out. She brings her two daughters-in-law until she realizes, I can't take them with me. They don't belong there. They belong here. This is their homeland. They should stay. One stays. The other, named Ruth, says, I'm going with you. I'm not going to leave you. And she pledges herself like none had ever or since. And as we said last week, Ruth is turning toward and for Naomi. And that was evidence of how Ruth had turned toward God. And in that same instant, we also said that what was even more poignant was that Ruth was turning toward Naomi, but that was evidence of God turning toward Naomi in ways that Naomi didn't think were true or possible. And so here in our passage this morning, they're back in Bethlehem. And the first order of business to them both is, how are we going to eat? Reasonable concern, right? But this odd couple, Ruth and Naomi, they've already got two strikes against them, right? Naomi is aged. She's past her years. She's not going to be working in the fields. She can't do it. And Ruth is from Moab. And that's a nation that's reviled by Israel. You don't just walk the paths of an Israelite town if you're a Moabite and don't think that you're going to attract attention to yourself. You will. So they are in a tight spot. But the narrator of the story sends us at the very beginning of this chapter a very subtle message if the reader is thinking that Naomi and Ruth are doomed. He says in verse 1, now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. Now, we have never heard about Boaz before. We've not been introduced to him before. But as storytellers are wont to do, they like to give little hints that might end up being fulfilled. And sure enough, it's a fair bet that we're going to meet somebody named Boaz. And by verse 3, it says Ruth has happened to come into the field of Boaz. What's in that hint there? It's more than just a plot device. It's a theological as much as a narratival comment on the part of the narrator. The narrator is there to tell us that in this moment, God is at hand and he has a free hand. Because for most of what we've heard so far, one might be led to think that God is either out of the picture or he is conspiring to darken the picture. This family is out of food and they have literally lost all their breadwinners. And then Naomi, as we heard on Wednesday night, goes into a rant against God, where she believes that her calamity is at the feet of God. And so she says, that Lord, he's testified against me. He's brought calamity upon me. And the irony that we were surfacing on Wednesday night was this. Naomi is giving this rueful rant while there's this strong little woman at her elbow named Ruth, the one who had pledged herself to Naomi almost like a husband would. Naomi is convinced that God has taken up this adversarial posture toward her, whereas there's this Moabite woman who has declared herself an advocate for Naomi, as well as an advocate for God. Irony! And the narrator's subtle point is that God is at hand and he's working with a free hand. And brothers and sisters, believing God means believing that he is at hand and that he has a free hand, even when it feels like that all you've gotten from him is a backhand. Because there will inevitably be moments of anguish in your life. And in those anguished moments, you are going to be tempted to let your anguish before God spill over into anger for him. And the line between anguish and anger gets a little fuzzy there at the end of chapter 1 in Naomi's words. But the difference that I'm trying to strike here between anguish and anger is this difference. It's the difference between not understanding why God is acting as he has and concluding that you know that he's not for you. Those two postures are worlds apart. Anguish is asking why, and rightfully so. Anger, it's concluding why. And it's concluding that he's not for you. And that is a statement of faith as much as just being anguished is. With Ruth's presence at Naomi's side, and this hint of a relative named Boaz who might become part of the picture and the resolution, that's the narrator's way of telling us this. God's at hand and he has a free hand. And he has a free hand in two ways in this passage, both of which have to do with what it means really to believe God. And the first picture of God having a free hand and of what it means to believe God is found, as you might expect, in Ruth. She knows they're going to die without food. And she knows that among them, the two of them, she's the only one capable of securing them food. But as a Moabite woman in essentially hostile territory, she knows that the only way that they stand a chance of getting any grain is for favor to come to her and Naomi through someone shining it upon them. And so she says in verse 2, "Let me go to the field, glean among the ears of grain, after him in whose sight I shall find favor." And Naomi says, "Go, go, my daughter, go." "I'll go and glean," she says. "But it's going to need to be in the field of someone who's going to show me favor." In other words, kindness to glean from what is rightfully theirs. That's what's going to have to come to me. And it's not just anyone who's hoping in that. It's a Moabite woman. Brothers and sisters, there's something in that little decision of Ruth's. There is something there that's bigger than just the storyline itself. What we see here is faith, but faith that's expressed in two distinct and inseparable ways. It is faith that ventures, and it is faith that entrusts simultaneously. What do I mean? Ruth is venturing out, right? She is not hiding behind Naomi's skirt. She is not just sitting there in a prayer circle. She is taking a risk as a foreigner in a hostile setting, but she is going nevertheless because they will die if she doesn't. And so she's venturing. She's putting herself out there. She's not holding back. That's what we call venturing. That's the definition of venturing. But she is also at the same time entrusting herself. She knows it's going to require the kindness of a stranger to obtain what she needs. She can venture all she wants. But if a benefactor doesn't emerge, there will be no grain. End of story. End of venture. And so she is entrusting herself to God. She has already come to see the goodness and the mercy of Naomi's God. And that's why she's left Moab behind and says to Naomi, among other things, "Your God, he's going to be my God." She's seen that. She sensed that. She's concluded that. But now she has no choice but to entrust herself to his free hand that he might work in real time. Back in Moab, while Naomi is still trying to convince Ruth to stay in her homeland, Naomi says, "May the Lord deal kindly with you, Ruth, just as you have with me." And now that they're back in Bethlehem, Ruth has to believe that God is going to answer Naomi's prayer in a way that even Naomi couldn't have imagined. That's faith. That's what faith looks like. What it looks like to believe God. It means to venture yourself, and it means to entrust yourself. It means to take risk, but it also means to take refuge. It means to act deliberately, but not frantically. That's believing God. There's a quote from Martin Luther King Jr. on the front of your bulletin who said this. You've probably heard it before. "The belief that God will do everything for man is as untenable as the belief that man can do everything for himself. It too is based on a lack of faith. We must learn that to expect God to do everything while we do nothing is not faith, but superstition." If you're going to be a parent, there is no other option than doing all that you can, but then entrusting yourself and themselves to God with what you cannot. If you would ever bear witness for the gospel, it's not going to happen unless you speak. But nor will it really bear fruit unless God speaks over and above what your words might ever say. If the church is ever going to do anything to ameliorate poverty or clamp down on injustices or be a force of reconciliation, it will have to act. But none of those things will ever materialize sustainably apart from human agency. But we will have to entrust ourselves to what God does in the remaking of human hearts and in the remaking of human structures that underlie those social maladies. Unless He acts, all our efforts will bear no fruit. Believing God means a venturing, entrusting faith. That's what we see about believing God in Ruth. What about Boaz? He demonstrates it even more profoundly. And in a lot of ways that you will think, yeah, get that, right, practice that this week. It's very familiar. And then there are other ways where it's kind of like, wow, it's kind of subtle, didn't notice that. So let me bring out for you both, okay? What does Boaz do to give us a picture of believing God? If you had to summarize what he shows us about believing God, the narrator is happy to supply it in verse 2. Ruth is entrusting herself to God, and she says, may I find favor. And by verse 10, you know what she's doing? She's marveling in the fact that she's found favor. That favor comes to her through the person of Boaz. And that word favor is essentially a show of unexpected grace. And in Boaz's case, that grace comes manifestly in the form of kindness. We talked about kindness last week. We talked about how the kindness is usually a word that's ascribed to God. He is the one who is kind. And so we have to ask ourselves, in what ways did Boaz specifically show kindness in this passage? It's manifold. Boaz greets his men early in the passage as they're working in the field, but he immediately does one thing. He takes notice of Ruth. And a notice that's not just in the category of, well, that's different. It's a noticing that's more like, who is that? Why is she here? This is the curiosity of concern. And that's a kindness. Because it's then that his foreman explains just who Ruth is, where she's from, what she's already done on behalf of Naomi. And here's where translations kind of differ as to what happens next. They're not really certain. Does Ruth actually start in the field, start gleaning all the day long before Boaz shows up? Or does she stand there patiently waiting to be given permission to be able to glean? The text isn't really clear. All you Hebrew linguists and scholars, you can clarify for it later for us during Q&A. But in either case, Ruth is demonstrating the sort of tenacity that makes Boaz take notice. And the favor that is kind is that which looks around regularly and takes notice of who is near. And it begins to wonder, who are they? What are they about? Once that backstory gets filled in, Boaz noticing her immediately translates into another form of kindness. It's a kindness that turns into protection. He knows she's a woman. He knows she's from Moab. He knows how people act. He knows how men tend to act. He knows how Israelite men tend to act. He knows how people might want to take advantage of those realities. And so he looks out for her welfare by saying, you may certainly glean here, sister, or my daughter, he says. But make sure you stay here. Don't go anywhere else. Only here can I guarantee your safety, he says. Why is he doing that? Because kindness protects. It always does. And he demonstrates that kindness of protection in order to show her yet another form of kindness. The kindness of provision. She's not gleaning to just pass the time. She's gleaning so that she and Naomi can survive. And so he permits her to work in the field. Now, some might look at what Boaz does for her as unremarkable because, you know what? What does the law say? Let the sojourner and the foreigner and the impoverished glean the edges of your field. The law stipulated that. Don't harvest the whole thing. Leave some behind. Let them have the edges of your property, edges ungathered, so that they might have something to live off of. That's what Ruth was hoping to get permission of. And so we look at Boaz like, great, he's letting her glean her field. He's just following the law. He's just being a law-abiding citizen. That's not really kindness. That's just compliance. But you know what? Boaz goes beyond what the law stipulates. He doesn't allow her just to glean the edges. He says, glean among the sheaves. You know, whatever at the center of the field that they've been collecting, where the good stuff will have even fallen out of those bundles. And then he says, hey, boys, throw a few bundles of her stuff, bundles of your gathering, give it to her. His kindness goes beyond the letter of the law, and I would dare say thereby fulfills the spirit of the law. He shows kindness by providing her all she needed and more out of all that he had. It's kindness. That's kindness writ large. It's favor unfurled. And this all manifestly demonstrates what it means to believe God. And all of that's pretty obvious. You would have gone, yeah, saw that easily. Great. What else? A couple more things that are a little bit more subtle in Boaz. There's a CEO of a large company this week whose name of both him and the company shall remain nameless, who made a pledge of giving 99% of his stock away over the course of his life, right? You may have heard about that. And he made a distinction in making that disclosure, the distinction between charity and philanthropy, right? Okay, he says charity is just like dropping money in a bucket, right? You just sort of, hey, you need it, there's your money, go with it, right? Hope it works out for you. Philanthropy, he said, on the other hand, is taking a more comprehensive interest in the need, involving oneself firsthand in it, including through financial participation. Now, some might quibble about the distinction that he's making. A lot of people are quibbling over the motivation behind it. That shall not be the topic of discussion this morning. But while it might be hopelessly anachronistic for me to invoke that concept or that distinction, I think there's an analogy to be drawn here. Boaz is not making Ruth a charity case. He's not just loading her up with grain and saying, good luck. Hope you feel fed. When he invites Ruth to sit at his side at lunch, and when he invites her to partake of the roasted grain, of the bread that she might dip in the garnish that was a delicacy in that day, and when he passes her some roasted grain, this is the kindness of fellowship. Of being invited more than just into a meal, but into a life. And the most striking thing about that invitation, the most striking thing about that act of kindness, is who he's doing it to. It's to a Moabite woman who would have come with a reputation that, shall we say, was less than appropriate or kind. It is not for no reason that the story, that the narrator repeatedly reminds us of the fact that Ruth is from Moab. That reputation, if you're from Moab, was about as high as someone of Arabic descent in San Bernardino this morning. And just as stereotypical. And you know what? Boaz doesn't care what the reputation was. She's from a people that are less than prestigious in their origin, a people who had treated Israel in their past with contempt, and yet Boaz still treats her with favor and with kindness. And that's not lost on her. What does she say in verse 10? Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me since I'm a foreigner? It should ring a bell with you if you know the Gospel of John, because it's the Samaritan woman in John 4 who, when Jesus strikes up a conversation with her at the well, says, why are you talking to me? Jews don't talk to Samaritans. In both cases, in John 4, Ruth 2, this woman, she's an other. She's an outsider. Boaz treats her like an insider. That's kindness. There are political cartoons out there, right? But there are also theological cartoons. And I saw a beautiful one this week. It's very simple. It's just a bunch of people that are drawn on this massive floor. And these people are holding these life-size pencils. and they are drawing lines. And they're drawing little boxes of lines around themselves. And they're all inside their lines. They've created these demarcations between each other. And then there is one figure who is standing among them, who is also holding a large pencil. But this time it is upside down. And he has got his eraser going. And he is erasing the lines. He's erasing the lines. And that person is wearing a robe. And that person is wearing a crown of thorns. Boaz, like somebody who would come after him, saw fit to erase lines that were of no consequence. And he did so as an act of kindness. There's another quote on your bulletin from Sinclair Ferguson, who wrote this: "The real evidence of character and the ultimate test of spiritual maturity is not how someone reacts to the great, the famous, the rich, and the noble, but how that person has responded to the marginalized, the unnoticed, the poor, the struggler, and the needy. If all you do around those who are unlike you is feel awkward, God has work to do in you. God has work to do in me." Boaz's character reveals that which Sinclair Ferguson speaks of, and in doing so, he's showing us what it means to believe God. It's that kind of believing God that the kindness you show is essentially an answer to someone's prayer. Naomi had prayed that God would deal kindly with Ruth. Boaz, in this passage, says, "May the Lord repay you for your kindness that you did unto Naomi." And you know what? He prays that, and then Boaz becomes the answer to his own prayer. Believing God means showing faith that ventures and entrusts, but it also means showing such a comprehensive kindness that you practically become the answer to someone's prayers to God for kindness. That's what it means to believe God. It's not rocket science. Ruth and Boaz show us what it means to believe God. And the question that we all have to ask is, does Naomi at all show us what it means to believe God? Because what has she done in this passage? Guess what? Nothing. She's got at most a bit part. She says, "Go, daughter," at the beginning. And at the end, she's like, "Huh, you found him." That's it. That's all she does. And that's because, brothers and sisters, she could really do nothing. She can't work the field, she can't find Boaz, and she surely can't convince Boaz to show favor or kindness to Ruth and herself. She could do nothing. Brothers and sisters, in doing nothing, she nevertheless shows us something. What? What does she show us about believing God? This: believing God means that there are some matters when all you can do is nothing. When the only thing you can bring to the table is your need. Naomi did that. The only thing she had to offer was her need, but that need was enough. For in having only need, she shows us why she needed the likes of Ruth's faith and Boaz's favor and ultimately God's kindness to work through them for her good. But at the same time, and more importantly, Naomi shows us of our need of the one to whom Ruth and Boaz ultimately point. Ruth and Boaz acted in concert by the free hand of God to secure bread for Ruth and Naomi. But brothers and sisters, it was someone who said once, "Man shall not live by bread alone." Our need for bread is real, but it will always go deeper than that. If you're wheeled into an emergency room and the resident who has been attending to you is explaining to you about everything that he's going to do during surgery, and then all of a sudden the chief of surgery shows up and says, "You can go, I got to take care of this one." If you're the patient, you're realizing perhaps my need is greater than I personally suspected if the chief of surgery has to come in and do the job. For God to make himself flesh upon the earth, for Jesus to live and to die and to rise again, that is testimony of just how deep our need is for what we cannot get apart from Jesus' faith and favor. Just like that of Ruth and Boaz's, but in far in excess of what they even showed. You weren't just an outsider, brothers and sisters. You weren't just an other. You were essentially and in effect an enemy of God. And yet Jesus has seen fit to erase the lines between you and him through his incarnation, death, and resurrection. And in seeing that you no longer look and seen as an outsider, you begin to see others in the same way that he sees you. Because it's his kindness that leads us to repentance, that leads us to showing faith and favor. Before you will ever believe like Ruth and Boaz did, you will have to believe like Naomi did. And you will believe like Naomi does when you believe that you can do nothing to get you a seat at God's table unless God comes in the flesh, unless God dies in the flesh, and unless he offers himself with nourishment in the flesh in this table that we're about to partake of. When you come to this table, brothers and sisters, I hope that you would see that this text is trying to tell us that he's asking us to believe God. And so I ask you, where do you need to exercise faith, adventures, and entrusts? Who needs the favor of God revealed through you so that you can become an answer to their prayer? God knows. And hopefully you will know in time. And so when you come to this table, I would ask you to ask him, how do you need to believe him next? And then would you see how he believed that you were worth dying for? And then breathe deep. Breathe deep the breath of God.